welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you decided to join us today. Police violence, police brutality is something that we in America are really familiar with, and those of us who are African Americans are more familiar with it than many other Americans. According to the NAACP, African Americans are 5 times more likely to be stopped, for instance, by law enforcement. And already, more than 360 people of all different backgrounds have been killed this year in the U.S. after being shot by law enforcement. Think back to 2020 as the pandemic was really getting started and at the height of the Black Lives Matter protest. Back then, 9 out of 10 Americans said racism and police brutality were problems in our country. There was a specific case, of course, that spurred that summer of Black Lives Matter in 2020. George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, was suffocated by one police officer while 3 others looked on. And in fact, that's a very sanitized way of saying what happened to George Floyd. Derek Chauvin, the police officer, kneeled on George Floyd's neck for 8 minutes until he stopped breathing. Keith Ellison is the Minnesota Attorney General and the lawyer who led the prosecution against the police officers who were involved in George Floyd's killing. And he's got a new book out called Break the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence, which documents that case from start to finish and talks about what we could be doing to interrupt this cycle. Break the Wheel is part memoir, part historical document, and part guide to the way that the legal system handles police brutality. And this book leaves us with an awful lot of questions. What does police violence look like? Why is it cyclical? That is, why does it happen with such regularity? And why can't we interrupt it? How do we hold police accountable when they commit violence that sidesteps the boundaries of their work? That's where we begin the conversation today. And with us to discuss it is Keith Ellison, the Attorney General of Minnesota and a native Detroiter. Keith, welcome back to Detroit Today.
Hey, great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation. As you know, I was born and raised in Detroit.
Yes, you were.
it's always a pleasure to talk with WDET.
Yes, and I think I would be remiss if I didn't also note that you are a graduate of the University of Detroit Jesuit High School, which is also my alma mater. So it's great to have you.
There you go.
So I want to start here. You call police violence a cycle. I want to have you talk about what you mean by that. How does police violence show up in American communities, and why is it so persistent?
Well, you know, when I started really studying the history of this problem, I went back to the 1919 Chicago, what they call it, a race riot, when academics pulled together and had an investigative committee to really study what happened with that Chicago 1919 riot that was sparked by, a tragic incident between police and community. What happened is that a black boy was swimming in Lake Michigan and he floated over to the white section of the beach. Mm-hmm. Some people threw rocks at him, caused him to lose his balance and fall off and drown. When citizens came and said to the police, hey, what are you going to do with that? That they got violent treatment. And as a result, there was this, what they call, what history reports as the Chicago race riot. And then there was the 1935 Harlem one, the 1943 Harlem one. Then there was the Kerner Commission in 1968, mm-hmm. which looked at a whole bunch of disturbances, including the Detroit uprising, which occurred just the same year before But then after that, there was the Christopher Commission report that happened after LA, right? And Rodney King. And then even up into and including the Ferguson incident, you had President Obama commission a study on the 21st century policing. So there is this cycle. It's just there, and it rolls along, and it causes tremendous social problems, starting with loss of life or loss of safety. But it also has a heavily negative impact on municipal budgets. In Minneapolis alone, my city, we paid over $100 million in police misconduct lawsuits in the last 10 years alone. Detroit has similar numbers. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Cleveland, every city has to budget heavily for these cases. And then, of course, we about every 5 to 6 years, there is a tragic incident which sparks a massive public response in terms of protesting and things like that. So, I mean, this is an expensive flaw that we have, that we won't fix this problem, causes a lot of trouble. It also reduces trust between law enforcement and citizens, which I believe leads to lesser safety. So that is what the whole book is about. You know, we have this cycle. It is longstanding. It is nationwide, and it is expensive in life and in treasure, and we need to fix it.
Yeah. So when police violence happens, let's talk about the most common response from other lawmakers or people in power. And I think that is one of the pivot points on this issue, right? That once something like this happens, there is an inappropriate, really, response to what's happened and in terms of what other officers think and what lawmakers do. What's the first thing that happens to a police officer who is accused of committing inappropriate violence against a civilian?
Well, on the scene, they call it a critical incident. Once it is apparent that the officer, him or herself, may be suspected of wrongdoing, they get their union gets together with them. Generally speaking, and I can't speak for every single case, but generally speaking, they don't say anything. They have their lawyer issue some kind of a statement with due regard to their defense, then depending on the level of whether there's video or whatever, there is. The prosecutors start to think about whether to release the videotape, whether to release the information. That process is usually pretty difficult to manage for people. And then there has to be some sort of prosecutorial decision. That prosecutorial decision may be made by the local authority where it occurred, or may be transferred out. There's sort of a unraveling of a number of steps that are going to happen in the immediate aftermath. And quite honestly, we haven't dealt with it very well. I will commend the Memphis Police Department and County Attorney's Office, because they, in the aftermath of the Floyd matter, released the videotape fairly quickly, discharged the officers fairly quickly, and charged them. And so, if you look at Memphis, it looks like once these tragic incidents happen, we're now starting to figure out what to do about it. But for many years, it was just chaos, and you had upset community, and you had the union saying, hey, our guys didn't do anything wrong, and we're not going to tolerate any sanction against them. And that's sort of how those things spin out. And that pattern gets replayed and played all the time. Mm. One of the things that happened in Minneapolis is that the Minneapolis Police Department public information officer, the very night that this tragic incident with George Floyd happened, issued a statement saying that George Floyd died in a medical incident. Mention force, didn't mention the people screaming for the life of George Floyd, didn't mention the videotape, didn't mention anything, just sort of an inebriated person suspected of forgery died in police custody due to medical complications. That was it. Mm. And then when the video came out, the contrast couldn't be more stark. That's one of the things. You got to get your information right, because if you get it wrong, you're going to immediately sow distrust, and people will feel that a just outcome is not possible, and they will take to the streets.
Yeah.
And so that's another one of the fallouts of this kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm talking with Keith Ellison. He's the Attorney General of Minnesota, author of a new book titled Break the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence. Ellison is the person who prosecuted Derek Chauvin and the other police officers in Minneapolis who killed George Floyd in the summer of 2020, sparking the massive Black Lives Matter protest, not just here in Detroit or in Minnesota, but all over the country. We're talking about how you break the cycle of police violence. How do you interrupt the things that seem to happen and then happen again in our country and have happened for such a long time? We want to hear from you, the listeners, as well. During the conversation, give us a call and let us know if you feel like the police are there to protect you, or do you fear their presence in your community? Are you someone who has experience with police violence, or have you been violated in some other way by someone who was there to protect and serve? If you're a police officer, let us know if you've seen other officers step out of line and do things that they shouldn't be doing. What was your response like? What's it like to have to call out other officers for their behavior? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you in the conversation that way. Keith, before we get to our listeners, I want to talk just a little about what you did in the George Floyd case, or the Derek Chauvin case, and what effect it's had on this problem. As you point out, inside of the police department in Minneapolis, inside the legal establishment in Minneapolis, the call was not to respond to this with a prosecution. You decided, as the Attorney General, that you would prosecute, and you got a conviction for not only Derek Chauvin, but some of the other officers. What message did that send about the way we deal with that? And are you seeing a difference in not only Minneapolis, but other jurisdictions in Minnesota as a result?
You know, this question, are we seeing a difference? The answer is yes and no. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the numbers, we have not seen a reduction and deadly force encounters with police. We have not really seen the numbers go down, but we have seen laudable efforts to try to improve the situation. And in Minneapolis, we were able to hire a reform-minded chief who seems to be doing a great job. Got to give Brian O'Hara a lot of credit. We have a commissioner of public safety. In fact, they converted from only a police department to a commissioner of public safety, which combines police, fire, 911, youth violence intervention, medical, emergency medical services, and kind of does public safety as a more holistic thing. So that's a positive development. They've banned no-knock warrants, banned chokeholds. These things are important and helpful, but in terms of the actual numbers nationwide, we really haven't seen the outcomes that we want. We haven't seen much happening in Congress. Congress has not done what it should do. President Biden issued an executive order, which is commendable, but Congress has let the George Floyd Justice of Policing Act stall, and that is unfortunate, mm-hmm. no question. So, I mean, you know, when people, I know it's easy to just say nothing's happened, everything's happened. Well, a little bit of both, right? I mean, people are responding, local leaders are responding. But one of the most important things is that your average juror or citizen is more sensitive to this subject. There was a time when, you know, you could pretty much count on every doubt being resolved in favor of police. Mm-hmm. And now jurors are open to hear the case. They're listening. We've seen this in the civil arena and in the criminal one. I think the days are gone when just thinking that the juror's going to acquit is I think we've entered a new territory. And I also think that it's commendable for a lot of police officers to start speaking out now. I mean, police chief Arredondo fired those officers. The longest serving Minneapolis police officer, Richard Zimmerman, said, hey, look, this is wrong. We must condemn this. We can't stand by this kind of behavior. I've talked to a lot of different police leaders and rank and file officers who say, look, we need to change the culture. We believe it can change. But if you are trying to tell your supervisor that they need to stop doing something that they're doing, that can ruin your career in law enforcement. How does a more junior officer confront a more senior officer when the more senior officer is doing something that is unconstitutional and inhumane? That's something that we've got to work on. That's a cultural issue. But there's a lot of things happening. But to get the actual numbers down, we're still pretty much where we were.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Keith Ellison about his book, Break the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence. We'll also get you, the listeners, involved in the conversation. Daniel in Detroit, Glenn in South Park, Zeta in Highland Park, Josh in Beverly Hills. You'll be up first. If you want to join them on the phones, 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET provides trusted news, inclusive conversations, and cultural experiences that empower the community. 101.9 WDET, Detroit's public radio station.
Right today on 101.9 WDET, I'm Stephen Henderson, and our guest is Keith Ellison, the Attorney General of Minnesota and author of a new book titled Break the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence. Ellison is the person who prosecuted Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. Derek Chauvin and several other officers actually in Minneapolis were held responsible for that. We're talking about how do you interrupt that cycle of police violence that we've lived with very prolifically here in the United States. African Americans, of course, have their own story about relationships with police and police authority. We want to hear from you, the listeners, as well. Give us a call and let us know what you make of the relationships we have with police officers in our communities. Are you someone who sees the police as protecting our communities, or do you feel like there's something to be afraid of in our communities? Are you someone who's experienced police violence or been violated in some way by a police officer? If you're an officer, we'd love to hear from you as well. Talk to us about policing our communities. Also, talk to us about the way you respond when you see other officers stepping out of line. A real critical point in all of this is the idea that police too often don't call each other out for inappropriate behavior. The number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today. Let's start today with Zeta in Highland Park. Zeta, what's on your mind?
Yeah, well, Zeta from Highland Park, thank you again. Beautiful topic. It's very much needed in society. The police is not here to protect and serve. First of all, you have to know the history of the police and who they were and what they were. They were slave catchers. Mm-hmm. They were the people who would go out and get the slaves and bring them back. So it's like now it's like we're dealing with, as an African-American woman in America, I've been kidnapped by the police. And when I say kidnapped, I mean I've been minding my own business on the streets in the back in the early 90s. The police have taken me just because I look suspicious to them and arrested me, and I was held in jail for like days and then released for nothing. It's like nothing was ever done about it. a lot of this treatment has happened to me throughout my life in America, in Detroit, Michigan. So, no, the police are not our friends, and you have to be careful when you do encounter them. You have to know how to act. You have to make sure you're not aggressive, because, like George Floyd, I'll come from even deeper with that, Malice Green, back in 92. Mm-hmm. I lived in that area when they killed Malice Green. So it's like that's what got me involved in fighting against police brutality against black people. So I'm saying to everybody, it's a shame where we are right now with this, because you got black cops, black police officers who won't even stand up against this type of injustice. So then they wonder why none of us, the people, don't like them. So I hope that in America that these type of things change, because it's a shame what has been going on, how they've been killing black people.
No question. Zena, before I go back to Keith Ellison, I want to have you talk about what you think the solution is. And I don't mean to put, you know, all the pressure on you as an individual, as one citizen, to try to solve the problem. But as somebody who's had negative interactions, negative experiences with the police, what would you think is a reasonable way to fix all of that?
I think it's in the training. Like when they're in the police academy or whatever, it's like racism is a very difficult thing to deal with. It's like we need all hands on deck for this. So it's like all professions, like when people are to be cops, they need it's more than sensitivity training. They have to. I really don't know the answer to that question fully, but something has to be done. And I believe it starts with being in training and the people who are like authority figures, like the people who are the bosses of those people. They have to, it's something that they need to go through training to sensitize them and just to see if they mentally are able to do the job, which is being asked of them.
Yeah. Zena, I really appreciate your call and you sharing your experiences. Keith, I want to have you react to what she's saying. These are stories we hear in our community all the time about, people being inappropriately dealt with by police, that you can be doing almost nothing and end up in an entanglement with a police officer. Also, the question of training and whether that's a solution.
Well, certainly training is part of it. I would say this. If you look at the George Floyd matter, what training did the officers need to have that they didn't have to just stand up when George Floyd said, "I can't breathe"? Or what about when he went limp completely and was offering no resistance at all? He wasn't even saying a word. What about when he didn't have a pulse? What is the training that says, okay, now get up off this person? Now, they did have, all of them had, lots of CPR training. But when George Floyd was completely unresponsive and with no pulse, they did not begin chest compressions. They didn't do anything to intervene for him medically. You know, you begin to wonder, you know, is training the thing? I think training is very important. But, I mean, a 9-year-old girl was yelling, "Get off him, take his pulse, he's not breathing." 9-year-old girl. How come she understood more about what to do than they did? Mm-hmm. The police academy shouldn't make you less aware, less smart. It should make you more smart. It should certainly equip you better to handle a problem than a 9-year-old child or 3 17-year-old girls. One of them was Darnella Frazier, who videotaped the whole thing. What's the training that where you won't allow a trained firefighter to at least administer the medical emergency treatment? Who was on the scene? Genevieve Hansen was on the scene and said, "I am a firefighter. I'm here to help. Can I help?" And they're threatening to arrest her. So, look, I want to be clear. There are a lot of great police officers out there. I've met many. I think before training, there needs to be a realistic concern that if you violate the law, whether you have a badge or not, you are going to be held accountable. And if you violate rules like the duty to intervene, then you're going to have to face administrative discipline. The problem is one of impunity. Mm. The problem is, hey, look, our custom and our culture is I do whatever I want to these people and nobody's ever going to say a word about it. That's the custom. That's the culture. When you see Derek Chauvin staring at those people, you know, defiantly refusing to administer aid to George Floyd, You're not seeing a person who's dumb. You're seeing a person who's so sure that they're never going to have to answer to anyone for what they did.
Yeah.
And so what I think we really need is the system needs to say we have one standard of justice. Nobody's above the law. Nobody's beneath the law. Nobody can do whatever they want without any accountability. And there's nobody who you can do whatever you want to them and nobody in the system just doesn't care. We got to have one standard of justice. And then you can really use training because there's a lot of training that can be done.
Yeah.
And a lot of important training. And let me just tell you, I do believe we can solve this problem. If you look at Newark, New Jersey, and you look at Camden, New Jersey, those two cities have reduced officer-involved deadly force encounters dramatically. But it's because the mayor and the chief and everybody decided we're going to make these changes. And guess what? They're not paying out police misconduct judgments and lawsuits. They're not looking at civil disturbances every few years. They have greater trust. They've gotten more guns off the street. They got more citizen cooperation. So really dealing with this issue will make us, will save lives, protect the budget of the city, and we'll have greater safety for all citizens.
Yeah. Zena, again, I really appreciate the call and your candor. Let's go to Josh in Beverly Hills. Josh, what's on your mind?
Since the start of this segment, this radio station should be ashamed of itself for the obnoxious misinformation it's spreading. And I want to speak to the persons who fund this station. Listen to the misframing of every single thing said by the host. A couple things before we move on to the specific case of George Floyd. Number one, only about 1,000 persons are shot and killed by officers in the country every year, and 10 of them, roughly, are by persons who are unarmed. That means that all the 300 persons cited earlier about the deaths thus far this year, only about 3 of those persons will have been identified as not having an arm or being a direct threat to the public or the officer at the moment. More police officers die through violence every year than perpetrators. You're more likely to be killed by being struck by lightning than to be killed by a police officer in this country. The framing of the cultivation that authors like yourself and announcers like yourself on the radio, we're cultivating an audience of hysterical, misinformed people that repeat these misinformations. The idea that any place on the planet at any time in history was less racist than the United States in 2023 is fiction. No place is perfect, but this place has gone the furthest by any measure. On to George Floyd specifically. I noticed that the author here didn't make mention of the fact that Mr. Floyd was saying that he couldn't breathe whilst he was in the car by himself, and he was taken out of the car after arrest in order to, when he began to resist arrest again. That a crowd had gathered around a few police officers, and I'm not excusing Mr. Chauvin. He certainly could have conducted himself in a better fashion to preserve Mr. Floyd's safety. However, when you have a screaming crowd on the street demanding things of the police officers are human. They're terrified in these cases. Any one of these screaming people could immediately turn violent and assault, shoot, or otherwise harm these officers. Okay?
Okay, Josh, I don't want to cut you off, but we can't have you talk the whole show. And I do want to have Keith address what you're saying. I do want to say up front, though, Josh, that the framing that you're talking about for these conversations on this show, especially conversations like this, has to do with not just my outlook on life or my ideology, but the things that I know and have experienced personally. I grew up here in Detroit in the 70s and 80s. And I can tell you, as someone who doesn't have a criminal record, that the run-ins that I've had with police as a teenager, especially a teenager driving a car in Detroit in the late 1970s or late 1980s and early 1990s, tell me about the ways in which police interact with African Americans. It's not just about whether they might kill you. It's about whether they might roust you, whether they might assault you, whether they might search your car for no reason. There's a pattern of disparate treatment that I think is undeniable. And look, you're right. This is a country that's made tremendous strides in terms of equality from its beginning to now. But to say that it is the least racist place on earth, I think, is a bit of hyperbole. And it diminishes, again, the experiences that African Americans have. What you are saying is that our lives don't matter, our truths don't matter. And that's a really disturbing response to the things that we're talking about. But I want to give Keith Ellison a chance to respond specifically to what you're talking about, especially with the case of George Floyd.
Well, let me say, it is true that George Floyd said inside the car, he's having trouble breathing. He had claustrophobia. He told the officers that. But this prosecution really does begin when he's outside and when he easily could have been put in the recovery position. Instead, he was put in the prone position. And it wasn't just Officer Chauvin being on his neck. It was also Officer King pushing on his back and Officer Lane holding his legs and his hands being behind his back with his chest being the only thing supporting the full weight of all those people. So, you know, that's where it really does begin. And so for the caller, I just want to say, you're right. He did say, I'm having trouble breathing. But then what kind of response should that evoke? To me, that should be like, okay, well, why are you having trouble breathing? Let's get a truck here now. Let's put you in the recovery position so that you can regain your breath. Mm-hmm. I mean, police officers deal with people on their worst day. And there has to be some understanding that, you know, George, if George Floyd is having a medical problem, if he was, he wasn't, by the way, but if he was, maybe the right response is not to put him in a prone position and pile three grown men on top of him. So I'll just say that. I'll say, too, that there's simply no medical expert by the defense or the prosecution who would support the idea that the crowd is why the officers did not engage in medical in CPR. Mm-hmm. Nobody said that. Even the defense couldn't find an expert to say that. Because what was the crowd yelling about? They were saying he can't breathe.
They were kneeling on his neck.
Right. Right. They were saying, check his pulse. That's why they were raising their voices. They weren't just yelling for no reason. They were yelling for medical intervention. And so there's that. And I'll also say this. It is true that around 1,000 people a year are killed by law enforcement. Many of those people who are killed by law enforcement are not killed illegally or unconstitutionally. The police do have the right to use force, even deadly force, to protect themselves and to protect others. So that 1,000 isn't even, it's not all of those are unconstitutional or illegal. But I will also say, and this is to your point, it's not an even distribution across all Americans.
Right.
It's concentrated in certain communities. So if you're not in that community, you may think there's no problem. But if you are in that community, you'll say there's a serious problem. Contrast this last caller from the first one. The first one said there's a real serious problem. Mm-hmm. The second one said there's no problem at all. That's why I'm glad you're doing the show, because this is the chance for Michiganders to hear from each other and try just a little bit to see the world that the other person lives in. Because if all we do is say my world is the only one that matters and in my world everything's fine or everything's bad, then we never get to the point where we can understand each other and move forward in a positive way. I'll also say this. When a person is a victim of crime by a private individual, that's a horrible experience. That person needs to be investigated and they gotta be prosecuted. When you're the victim of a crime from a private individual, that's a serious matter. But when you are the victim of a crime from a state actor carrying with them the legitimacy of the state, mm-hmm. that's another matter altogether. Now we're talking about, do we live in a democratic society? The Fourth Amendment says there should be no unreasonable search and seizure. The Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable and arbitrary violence from the government. This is a universal principle. It's not only in the American Constitution, but it is there. So I'll say that when a private citizen does something bad to me, the police are going to arrest them, process them through the courts. what about when the system does something bad to me? We've got to have some levels of accountability there too. So I would just say for both of your callers, please have a little bit of patience for the person who walked a different path than you did.
I mean, that's a really difficult thing, not just in this community, but in this country, to get people to understand what the day-to-day existence is for African Americans, the communities that we live in, the problems that we deal with, and the response that we get very frequently from authorities. It is different. It looks different fundamentally. And these are things that we learn as little kids, right? Keith, you and I both grew up in Detroit about the same time.
Yep.
You're not 5 years old before you understand the difference between black and white in other people's eyes. And we do need people to understand that that's not made up. That's not cultivating a sense of victimhood or any of that kind of thing. It is real. It is the way every African American, whether it's Keith Ellison, who's the Attorney General of Minnesota, or me, who's the host of this show, or any black man or woman walking the streets, it looks different. Josh, I do appreciate the call, though. I do appreciate that you listen to the show and continue to participate in the conversation. That is an important part of what we're doing here. All right, we're going to take another quick break. We're going to come back, continue talking with Keith Ellison, who's the Minnesota Attorney General. We're also going to add another voice to the conversation. We're going to talk a little about what's going on in Washtenaw County, where they are experimenting with co-responders, mental health workers who are going with police officers and sometimes without police officers to go and respond to calls. Stay with us. Stay with us on the phones, 313-577-1019, and stay with us on social. Go to Twitter and hashtag us. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've joined us. Our guest is Keith Ellison, Minnesota's Attorney General, author of a new book titled Break the Wheel, Ending the Cycle of Police Violence, about his prosecution of Derek Chauvin and other police officers in Minneapolis for their murder of George Floyd in 2020. We're talking about how you interrupt that cycle. We want to hear from you on the phones and on social as well. I also want to introduce another voice to the conversation. Trish Cortez is Executive Director of Washtenaw County Community Mental Health, and her department works with the county's sheriff to deploy mental health workers alongside police officers to respond to and to respond to public calls without the police. Trish Cortez, welcome to Detroit Today.
Good morning. Yeah.
So,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here because I think you have an important dimension to add to this conversation. Let's talk about the idea of sending mental health responders into the field. How did that come about in Washtenaw County, and how's that working?
So in we started in about 2011. We had a smaller team, primarily of social workers, that would respond in the community to when we were actually getting phone calls around an apparent mental health crisis. And our team at that time, the social workers would go out, respond, kind of try to resolve the issue at hand, and then offer more social supports and resources. Since that time, we've really been able to build out that team, starting in about 2018, and really expand that team beyond just the social workers, but to also be able to do crisis response plus stabilization, which has been a real game changer for us, where we can not only address the crisis in that moment, but then also provide some follow-up. And so that's where we're at today. As we'll talk more about how we do that with law enforcement.
Yeah. The partnering with law enforcement is something that I think we're seeing a lot of communities think about. Talk about how what effect that's having in Washtenaw on police response itself. That you know, I mean, police are trained to deal with certain things. They are not trained to deal with mental health. Does having somebody there who is a mental health professional make a difference for the person that they're responding to?
Absolutely. So typically when we respond with law enforcement, what has been happening historically in the sheriff's office and CMH have got a current pilot that's, you know, relatively new, but typically what occurs is law enforcement will actually call us to go and coordinate a response mm-hmm. at the location that they're at. So what happens the majority of the time is a community member will call 911. 911 will dispatch law enforcement to that location. And when the officer arrives at that location, they're recognizing that there is a mental health issue at hand, and they will actually call us and ask us to go out and respond with them. And that's what our typical law enforcement coordinated response looks like.
Are you seeing an effect with the people that are being responded to by law enforcement when there is a mental health worker there? I know that may be hard to quantify, but I'm trying to get some sense of how different this looks than when police respond on their own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we've done this work here in Washtenaw County for some time, and the vast majority of our law enforcement officers have been trained in how to manage a mental health crisis, which then really just allows that law enforcement individual, especially because if there's no crime being committed, they can leave the scene. And we, from there, then can engage them in mental health services, substance abuse services, or whatever support that individual may need. So absolutely, there's, you know, there we definitely have data that shows that law enforcement here in Washtenaw County are really able to just refer on individuals experiencing a mental health condition or crisis to us, and we kind of take it over from there.
Yeah. Keith Ellison, I want to bring you back into the conversation here and
sure.
have you talk just about this as a solution, the role that it might play in breaking this cycle of police violence.
Hey, you know, let me just commend your work, ma'am. This is what my idea of helping to break the wheel, right? This is how we get there. When I mentioned a little earlier that when I became the Attorney General of Minnesota, me and the Commissioner of Public Safety of Minnesota pulled together a task force on reducing deadly force encounters involving police. And one of the things we came up with is that a very high percentage of the officer-involved deaths involve people in a mental health crisis, and that the officers just, they didn't know how to handle it. They didn't know what to do. And things sometimes went awry. If we had people who were trained mental health professionals, it might really improve outcomes. And you know what? The city of St. Paul is using it. The city of Minneapolis is too. Washtenaw County, I'm so glad to hear, is doing it. And I think that you are really onto something, and I hope you will continue. And I hope you'll write about what you find, because I think there's a lot of jurisdictions across the country mm-hmm. that are looking for answers, and this is one of them.
Yeah, yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's go next to Mary in Southwest Detroit. Mary, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. I'm so glad that you brought up your growing up years mm-hmm. because I'm here in Southwest Detroit. My son was killed, not by the police officer, but what came about was nothing. It was like one less Mexican in Southwest Detroit.
Mm. Mary.
Yeah. I've had a lot of experiences, and this was around the time you were growing up, by the way. And in fact, I think there were 600 murders. We had that was that period of time mm-hmm. when there was a very high murder rate.
Mm-hmm.
But my experience as a mother of Mexican boys, I was so frightened every time they walked out the door because of the police.
Mm.
not in, in those days, it was cash flow posse. By the way, my sons were not part of the cash flow posse. Mm-hmm. But in those days, the fear was not the gangbangers. It was the police. And I've worked for the recreation department, so I know a lot of the young people in the neighborhood and some of the experiences they've gone through, like one boy who said he had spit on the sidewalk. The police came, and he was Mexican, too. The cops came out of the car and said, "Hey, you spitting at us?" and took him and slammed his head against the police car. Yeah. And his two front teeth were broken out.
Mary,
and I can tell you, my other son went out the back door down the alley to his friend's house. He lives down the alley, and went around the front. Well, the police came and picked him up. In fact, his friend said, "I don't know. They got your son out, and the cops have your son. I don't know, you know, why."
Right.
Well, a paper boy had gotten robbed. My son is 6 feet, 6'1", maybe. He has black hair. And at the time he had a brown leather jacket. Well, the paper boy had gotten robbed by
Mary, I think I get the gist of what you're getting at here, that they just picked your son up because they thought he looked like somebody that had done something. And I don't want to cut you off, but I do need to get back to our guest to respond to this. Keith, that history is so important. And the length of time that we have been dealing with this in this community in particular, and that you and I grew up in, these are important stories to try to get out.
Yeah, Mary's story is very important. And I thank you for sharing it and you for taking it. I mean, here's the bottom line. If we can just allow ourselves a little bit of historical reference, you know, African-Americans were in slavery from 1619 to 1865. That's 246 years. Jim Crow for another 100 years. And then we've only lived in 60 years of anything else. And what that is disparities in every aspect of American life. Mary, her family is Latino. I mean, the history of Latino people in America is Northern Mexico was decapitated mm-hmm. in 1841. Mm-hmm. The Texas Rangers, you know, were attacked, you know, Mexican Americans relentlessly. When Brown versus Board of Education was heard, there were companion cases in Los Angeles involving segregation against Mexican people. So, you know, and then Japanese internment, all these things. This is our nation. We love our country. We're proud of it. We can't act like everything's fine, it's over, and it's not over, you know? And we've just got to commit ourselves to a better America, which we can have if we're willing to have the courage to have the conversation, you know? And to not shoot the messenger either, by the way. I mean, when you were talking a moment ago, I mean, I thought it was interesting that, you know, that one caller directed a certain degree of critique at your framing of the conversation. And I thought to myself that was unfortunate, because all you're trying to do is bring forth a conversation for our discussion,
right?
A serious problem which needs solutions. Yeah. And I really do hope that as a community, we will tolerate uncomfortable dialogue, not leap to the conclusion that I'm right, you're wrong, and that's it. I think that this service you're providing to us is really important, and I want to thank you for it.
No, I absolutely love this hour every day where we get to have these kind of conversations and listen to each other and learn from each other. Okay, Keith Ellison, Attorney General of Minnesota and author of Break the Wheel, Ending the Police, End of the Cycle of Police Violence. Always great to catch up with you, man, and I really appreciate you being here.
We'll see
us.
You soon, man.
Yes, absolutely. Also, Trish Cortez, Executive Director of Washtenaw County Community Mental Health. Really great to have you here to learn about what's going on in Washtenaw County as well. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Also, of course, thanks to our listeners, not just for being here, but for participating in our conversation. Sometimes it gets a little tense. Sometimes we get after each other a little bit, but that is what we're after here on Detroit Today, is an actual exchange, an honest exchange of our ideas and experiences. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. Come back tomorrow when we'll talk about what work looks like when it's not an identity, but is simply something you're just doing. It's just good enough. We'll talk again tomorrow.